So we're going to get started. My name is Scott Robbins, and I'm a Children's Services Specialist here at Toronto Public Library. And I have the honor today of interviewing Raina Telgemeier and Lynn Johnston. We're going to talk to you today a little bit about creator visits in schools and libraries. So please give a round of applause for these two amazing participants. So I feel like creator visits are one of those things that stay with us as kids forever. I remember when Gordon Corman visited my school when I was in grade 3, and it's something that I, you know, carry with me into my adult life, and I remember it and cherish it for a long time. But it's one of those things where you have this realization that, oh, there's people out there that are actually doing this. They're making these things called books. And I wanted to talk a little bit first about, when do you think that kids actually get that understanding that there's people that are creating these books? At what age?
I mean, I think I started realizing creators existed when I was 8 or 9 years old.
Wow.
When I started reading comics and started thinking about who was making these comics. And I mean, I was a big fan of like Little House on the Prairie when I was a little kid. And so knowing that Laura Ingalls Wilder was a real person gave me that sense, like, oh, someone's writing this book, but she's telling her own story, too. And, I mean, if a kid is exposed to libraries and books and authors when they're young, they'll just always know. But I don't think every kid gets that opportunity.
Right.
I think for me it was much younger. I think I was 5. As soon as I learned how to read, I was always interested in who had written whatever it was we were reading. And comic books came into our family quickly, but the Sunday funnies, you know, were always what we sat and read, and there was always the name of the writer there. And later, to meet some of these people was beyond my belief that I could actually meet these actual people that did this work, but the author was always as important as the script for my family anyways.
Right. And it seems now there's a lot more opportunities for creators and fans to sort of interact with each other, obviously because of online, but also I think that there's just a more of a focus of doing visits to schools and libraries. Why do you think that's kind of changed, that authors and illustrators aren't as sort of separate from the actual fans, that there's more of a conversation happening now?
I think librarians know, and schools, you know, preceptive teachers know how, just as you said, how important it is to have people come into the libraries and schools. I have some thoughts about that.
Please enlighten us.
I don't know how my classes behaved when I was enjoying visits from authors and artists in my school days, but today the kids are so disruptive that if I accept an opportunity to speak at a school, I say, only the kids who are really interested. Tell the rest of them to go find something else to do. Because, you know, I can point out in that class the number of kids who are exactly like me, who they don't want you to talk, they want to talk. And that was me, too. So I'll point them out and say, I know you right down to the tip of your sneakers. You are me, and you're an asshole. I can't say that word, but that's what I think, you know, and I point them out in the class, you know, that you've got to shut up long enough, but really, please don't make welcome the kids who are not going to spend any time, because to do a talk is a performance. You
Absolutely.
Prepare, you come, and anytime some bozo interrupts you, it's sort of like, you know, making some comment to some guy who's doing, you know, a play on the stage, right? And they got to go back to the script again. Act. Just bring in the kids that are really interested.
I've done, like, school assemblies where there's 500 kids, and some of the schools are, you can hear a pin drop because the kids are so well-behaved and so silent. And then there's always the ones that have the rowdy kids in the back, and the ones that are getting yelled at by their teachers in the middle of my talk.
I've never done that to any kids. You have my...
No, but I wish I could do what you just said you would do, which is to single them out. I had one kid once raise his hand and sit back in his chair and say, so how much money do you make? Which is a common question that we get asked. Kids always want to know, and they don't really have the know-how to know that that's not cool. So I actually looked the kid right in the eye and said, do you think your teachers approve of that question you just asked? And the kid just slumped down in his chair. I was so embarrassed, and I shamed him in front of 500 kids.
Good for you.
But then later in the teacher's room, the teachers were all like, I can't believe you said that to Cal. Wow, he's our worst student, and we told him ahead of time, no funny business. So I guess I did the right thing there. But usually my strategy for handling kids and libraries and schools is just to beg for a microphone. Because they often ask you to do these visits.
And they don't have the proper equipment.
Without the proper equipment, and if you're doing more than a room full of 10 people without a microphone, and they're louder than
good
you,
point.
You can't
good point.
You can't do this and say, okay! You have to yell into that mic sometimes.
Yeah.
But
good point.
I mean, I've had such great experiences, and I've had a couple of clunkers, but I think those are good odds.
So how many visits at schools or libraries have you done in your career so far, would you say? I'm just curious, because...
I started doing this about 10 years ago. I've probably done somewhere between 20 and 50 libraries, but I've done way more schools, like in the hundreds.
Holy cow, what am I doing here?
why do you think you tend to have more school visits than library visits?
I think because schools have budgets that are set up for that sort of thing, and library communities vary so much from one town to the next, but... I mean, schools nowadays seem like they have budgets for author visits.
Right.
And oftentimes they'll spend their whole budget on one author, and sometimes they'll spread that budget out amongst more people.
Right.
Yeah.
How many class visits have your school visits or
library
visits?
Very few compared. Honestly, I don't know that I could actually count, but maybe, I don't know, 25 schools, maybe 8 libraries, not that many. Because I don't like to do it. I really don't. I really hate it. And if you do one school in a community, then the others want you to do it. And I do it for free.
Right.
You know, that's why you don't like it.
Well, yeah. Even if I was paid, I wouldn't. Because you have to, whatever you do, if it's out of your town, it takes a day to get there, a day to do the thing, a day to get back. That's 3 days out of your life. And if you're a working cartoonist, you don't have 3 days. So even if they're paying me, it's not worth my while. And the thing that drives me crazy is kids who are disruptive and rude. And you say, you know what? I'm a good performer. I draw, I sing, I act, I play the game. And if you can't sit and be respectful for 20 minutes or whatever it is I'm on the stage, don't be there.
Right.
You know? So I hate it. And libraries are much better. Because there's a sense of reverence. People come to a library, it's a specific trip to go to a specific event. They have patience and common sense, and they respect the area that they're in. Parents bring the kids, they know that the kids are interested, so the people in a library generally are interested.
Right.
Libraries are much better. Much better.
And the librarians in the audience. We kind of talked a little bit about this. Do you find that there are any major differences? Lynn, you discussed that, you know, the differences between, you know, having disruptive kids at a school visit and more of that sort of reverence for the space in a library. Can you think of any other sort of major differences between doing school visits and library visits?
In schools, you have to be there.
Exactly.
The kids are there against their will sometimes. And that leads to a lot of the problems that you're talking about. Whereas a library, it's usually voluntary. It's usually an extracurricular thing. And librarians can try to get their kids excited about what's about to happen. And if the whole community starts to pull together, like, author visits at libraries can be beautiful things.
Right. Do you find... Oh, so go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Continue.
No.
I was going to say, do you find that teachers ever kind of force you to, you know, tie things into particular curriculum or anything like that? Like, do they place any specific demands on you as a creator in terms of what you should be presenting or anything like that? Or is it pretty much free reign?
They want you to get pedantic, and they want you to sort of be like, and this is the lesson, kids, that you should be taking away from this. But it doesn't happen that often. usually what I have to say sort of just falls neatly into what they want me to say, but anytime I have to add something that's more canned, I feel really unnatural doing it.
Right, right.
Fumble it.
I was always preempted by the fact that For Better or For Worse was out there, and people just assumed it was family-friendly stuff. And so when it came to making any direct statements with my presentation, I don't remember ever being asked to do anything other than just talk about what I did and how I did it. And I draw when I talk, so that takes up quite a bit of time. But I guess the one thing that I found lowers the sense of involvement is an overly long introduction by the person who is bringing you on stage. Typically, if somebody's coming, they know who you are, and perhaps they might even have a little bio. You don't need any more than, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, here's our friend, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And then you get going. Because I remember once going to Mike Peters, does Mother Goose and Grimm. Now, Mike Peters is a stand-up comedian. He's funny. He's clever. He draws. He is just a one-man band. And you go to a presentation where they say, ladies and gentlemen, here's our favorite Mike Peters. Everybody goes, yeah, and the volume and the sense of connection is right there at a high level all the way through his talk. But you get somebody who gets, you know, like a 5-minute introduction, and, you know, the enthusiasm goes down, 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 and you're sort of like, hey, that was funny, you know, like everybody's sort of waiting to get up. And this is Mike Peters! He does a great job, you know? So can the introduction just give everybody a little slip of paper that says this is what so-and-so does in their spare time and let the presenter go ahead?
Yeah, I guess people forget that with kids, the attention span is quite small. So
yeah.
you gotta get things going as quick as possible. Could you provide some examples of common don'ts in arranging or organizing or hosting creator visits? So don'ts by either the librarian or the teacher or the administrator that is put on the or arranging the visit.
Where to begin?
I knew this would be a good topic to discuss.
And I still don't want to get nasty. I want to try to keep it focused on the positive. But I've seen visits where, like, no one knows you're coming. I'll show up for my event, and the person at the front desk is like, we don't have an author event today. And I have to tell them, yes, you do. So everybody at the library should know that an author is coming. And then they should tell their patrons. And I've shown up for visits where there's, like, one flyer in the elevator that just has, like, a short block of text, no pictures, no nothing. It's just, like, my bio, she has done these books, she'll be here today. Like, wow, that was all the outreach you did and all of the prep work that you put into this, so of course you're not going to get anybody coming to the visit. It's not fun to show up to a visit where the only people there are your husband and the librarian who put the thing together. I don't recommend waiting until the last minute.
So publicity.
Publicity's
more
good.
Publicity.
We got to the point where we would actually send ahead the publicity they needed, the posters, the stuff, and they still didn't put it. You know, so that is such an important point.
Right.
And then, you know, not having the books and stuff. That's a big deal, but that happens more than you would imagine. It's nice to have book sales when you're doing an event. So not all libraries are comfortable with that, but most librarians have access to either a bookstore or a comic store, or even, you know, if it comes to it, the internet. But having a way for people to buy the books that you make after your talk, I think,
right,
is really essential.
Can you think of anything else, then, in terms of absolute don'ts when it comes to creator visits?
I can think of a couple others.
Keep going. We've got time.
I mean, anytime you're asking somebody to do more than one session, give them a bathroom break in between that session or those two sessions. Even if it's 10 minutes, a break for bathroom and water or a coffee is lovely. I had another one, and it just left my head.
Often people will invite their friends to visit with you because you're well-known. And so the person who's organizing your appearance has invited their best friend and their mother to come along, and these people often try to dominate your time afterwards. Whereas the people in the audience who sometimes have paid or have made an extra effort to be there, you want to connect with them. You don't want to have anything to do with so-and-so and hear about their dog. You want to focus on the people who have taken the time to come to see you. So I find that very, very frustrating, and I've actually been rude to people. I mean, I'm not a rude person, but after a while you just are outspoken, right? Because you know that you have a certain amount of time and only so much to do in that time.
And I have an on switch and an off switch. So when I'm in performer mode, when I'm on a stage, the switch is on, and I am 100% ready to give myself and everything that I have, but when the switch is off and the performance is over, I kind of need to go back to, like, being in my little shell. So I think that ties into what you're saying, too, is that you don't want to be on for people.
I am
after.
On.
Are you?
I am on, and I've noticed other people who are performers are on, too, until they get back to their hotel room.
Oh, wow.
And I'm on the whole time, and I've got that sort of, like, Barbie doll, you know, and I say the same things, and I make sure that people aren't within my hearing distance so that I can say it again, and I play a crowd because it's important for you to do so, I think, just because they have taken the time to come, and there are especially people who have young children who are really into comic art, and if they can make eye contact with you, shake your hand, and say, I love to draw, then you know that you've told them, I'm a real person, I have a real house, a real pen, a real piece of paper, and I really do what I do, and that's great. But when people dominate the floor with too long an introduction and then bring your mother along, it's just tough to be pleasant.
I call it get your own show. It's like when people are, like you said, dominating the conversation, it's like, there's a specific guest here to perform for you. You're not the one who's performing. So I can see how that can be quite frustrating as the person who's, there to do the performance, that someone is trying to sort of step on your toes a little bit.
I have to say most people are wonderful. Most venues are wonderful. Most people are wonderful. Most situations are wonderful. It's the few odd ones that you remember.
Yes.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, can you think of any sort of particularly memorable visits that either positive or negative or both that really stick out in your mind as being like something that was really fundamental to you as a creator and having a specific interaction with your fans?
Well, I did real situations based right on my family. So anytime I had done a real situation like the death of the dog or the grandfather having Alzheimer's, anytime I did a presentation, that was very much part of the ambiance in the room. The people wanted to come afterwards and say, I got to tell you, when that happened, this is what happened to me and my family. So countless times I have felt like I have touched someone heart to heart, and it's like I've known them forever, because they're opening up and suddenly telling you personal things because they feel that you will understand and that you will, you will sympathize with them, and I really do feel drained after some things because people are so emotional and so outward about it. Yeah. And often the person who's invited you has had that happen.
Right.
And you end up feeling overwhelmed by the reason they invited you in the first place, So I enjoy that, but it is a surprise even now.
Right.
Exact same experience with kids who have read Smile or are going through braces or something similar to what's in this story, and they want to tell me all about it. And I'm like, we can totally relate. That's pretty cool. As far as like specific visits that have been really successful, I went to St. Louis last year as part of this program where the St. Louis Library System, I think, they buy 500 or 1,000 copies of one book, and then they say to all of their patrons in the system, come and get a copy of this book, and the author is going to come and visit in 2 months. So read the book, enjoy it, and then come back and meet her. And it was one of the best library visits I've ever done because the kids were there, they were engaged, they were enthusiastic. They read the one book, and then they wanted to read a bunch of others. But I guess this library system does that every year. So it was a huge honor to have that happen. And there are libraries like the Toronto Reference Library that work with their community to put on a festival like TCAF. And TCAF is the biggest one that I've ever been to. I think it's probably the biggest library slash comic convention that exists. And they're just so much fun, and you guys can feel the energy at TCAF. And it's cute to see it on a smaller scale. Like, there's a festival in Ann Arbor called Kids Read Comics, and Scott was there last year, and it's like a 5% size TCAF, but it's really nice and it's really engaging. It's really nice to be in a library where the librarians are 100% behind what you're doing.
I have a little segue to a story. People tend to think that librarians are really dull.
No.
All right. One time I was at a convention in Chicago, and when I brought in my suitcase to the front desk, there was all these people come tumbling down the stairs, yelling and laughing and talking and singing and wow. And the girl at the desk said, "You're not one of them, are you?" And I said, "No, I'm a cartoonist, and there's an event about." And she said, "Oh." And I said, "Who are these people?" And she said, "Librarians." And whatever the convention was, whatever they were doing, they were having such a good time. And I've remembered that story ever since, thinking, wow. Just like cartoonists, there's an undercurrent of life there that we were just saying that we tend to work in basements, you know. And then we come out to an event like this, and you say, wow, look at all these people who are interested in what I do.
Yeah, it's so that, like, was fun. Creators are definitely the rock stars for librarians, and obviously for the fans of the books as well. So what are, would you say, the top three things in your experience that make creator visits the most successful?
Definitely outreach, working with your entire community to get everybody excited, not just the people that come to the library every day. Having the books in stock.
Yeah, we discussed that.
A third thing. Oh, gosh. I'm sure I'll think of something once Lynn starts talking, and then I'll be able to jump off that.
Well, you've done this so much more than I have. But I think one of the things, aside from the really positive things you've talked about, is afterwards, people will contact you and tell you what, you know, how your presentation affected them, or what happened afterwards, or if they had done a project based on your discussion. And that afterwards is so important, because you come, you do your presentation, and then you go home again, and life goes on for everybody, and you never know. It's like a teacher never knowing how that one student took that one idea and succeeded with it, you know, and forever telling everybody about the teacher, but the teacher never finds out. So for them to, either the people who were at the event or the organizers, to contact you afterwards and say, "This is how you were perceived," mostly positive, I hope. But that really is a great thing. It makes you feel as though you did the right thing. Because it takes your time. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to, you know, get out there and do the thing.
Right.
Snacks, that's my other suggestion.
And as, you know, we sort of touched on this, but I'd like to talk a little bit more about the balance that you have to have as a creator in doing school visits and library visits, and then actually doing the work. Because I know that because of this high demand for creators to come into libraries and schools, that sometimes the work can suffer, or sometimes it's on the back burner. How do you sort of balance those two things?
Did you ever take a sabbatical from Forever and Wars? Wow. Let's applaud Lynn for having that deadline for 30 years. It's insane.
No, and it is a really heavy-duty deadline. In order to go anywhere, you have to be 8 weeks ahead of the date that you come home. So you have to work ahead that far. Even with the internet and being able to send things electronically now, the syndicates have to send things as far away as Amsterdam and Guam and wherever else, you know, it's going out of there, and it has to be edited and colored and all of that stuff. So I was pretty deadline-oriented. Now that I'm retired, I can't believe I did what I did, because really, to do anything extra, to go to schools, to go to even to a stage presentation, if you're being paid to do it, you know, you keep asking for more and more money, and they still pay it, and you say, "Wait, I really don't want to do this," because it takes so many days out of your work day, you know. But having connected with, I always love it while I'm there. despite the fact that I'm saying, why did I do this? You know, when I'm going and while I'm there, I don't think I've ever been to an event that I have not been thrilled to be there, to connect with the people in the audience and to have that sense that whatever I do in my basement is read and appreciated by so many other people who have taken their time to come and see me. So I never, ever resent that when I'm there. I love it. And again, the people who are really insightful, the type of people who make a good dinner party, are the type of people who should really be organizing these things to say bathroom breaks and advertising. Because if people don't advertise, it doesn't happen.
Right.
I did like 50 visits in a year a couple of years ago. But I think that's because there's just so much competition in the book world and in the kidlit world to be, you know, an author who sells books. There's so many authors out there doing the same thing, and we all want that prize. And I thought, well, you know, getting in front of 100 people every week is the best way to get them pumped and want to buy my books. And that was also because I wasn't getting paid huge advances for the books, and I had to make the money stretch over the course of a couple of years, because a book takes a couple of years. I'm in a little bit of a better position now, as far as my finances go, and I've gotten a better handle on exactly how long it takes me to do a book. I know how many pages I can pencil in a day and so forth. So I'm able to budget my time a little bit better. And in the last year, I kind of cut back greatly on the amount of visits that I do, just because it was draining me. It was hard to go from being on for 3 days, traveling, doing the event, traveling home, and then finding that creative space I needed to be in order to make the work happen. And I feel like the creative space is getting smaller and smaller, and I need to chase it down more than I used to.
Great.
So it just means finding more quiet time.
You get to work in hotel rooms, you get to work on planes, you get to work...
I did pencil my book that's coming out in August, Sisters. I did pencil a lot of it on tray tables on airplanes, because I didn't have a choice.
Right.
But it's hard to say no, right?
It's so hard to say no. I want to say yes to everything.
Yeah. How did it... Did you find that you're getting better at saying no now that...
Yeah.
I was very lucky in that I had a syndicate putting my work out there, and I was paid very well. And on top of that were the books. The books were sold and marketed at one time very well by Anderson McNeil. Now books are in kind of this limbo. That's what I want to know more about, is where are books going, and librarians can probably tell me. You know, is it the microwave of the future that it's going to work as well with your stove in your kitchen as everything else? Or are books going to be, I mean, how are we going to read books in the future? Is it going to be on a little mechanical doodad, or are we actually going to have that wonderful book that we can turn the pages in? Where is it going? So, I get out now because I really want to, and not because I have to.
Right. And I think that's important, too, because obviously, like you said, you have to be on, and I think it's easier to be on when you actually want to be there. So, let's see. What age groups do you prefer presenting to? Do you have any sort of, you know, sweet spot for what age level that really sort of gets your work, or that you can really sort of connect with?
For me, it's the target demographic that my books are for. And I should add to that I had no idea who my audience was when I first started making books. I was making the books for myself. I was making the books for my perpetual 9-year-old girl reader of comics. But it turns out there's a lot of other 9-year-old girls that like to read comics, and they're the ones who respond the best to my work. Scholastic thought my work was aimed at 9 to 12. But it turns out it's a little closer to like 7 to 10 that seems to be that ultra, ultra sweet spot. But I get adults too, and I get teenagers, and I get kids who are 3 years old and are already reading comics and wanting to understand the words and the pictures together, whose parents read them the comics. So I hate the term all ages, as you may know, but I feel like there's a sweet spot, but it does play pretty wide.
Right.
I feel the same way. I enjoy all ages. I enjoy the challenge of all ages. Mostly it's a mixed audience, and you work with that. Because I draw while I talk, it's entertaining to young kids, and it kind of stops the teenagers from talking to each other. And so if it's a teenager who really loves comic art, I can't get enough of them. If it's somebody who's just there because they have to be, I can't get enough of them. don't come. But there's a certain connection between you and somebody who loves to draw that is almost like a chemical bond. It's like you and I both understand what it's like to daydream, and it's that real that you can draw it from all angles. It's 3D, you can walk right into it, and if the magic extends to somebody else, then wow. I heard the past, part of the past presentation where they were saying, as long as you can write, you don't have to worry about drawing. You can take clip art and it works. That's not what I would say. I would say that if you can draw really well, if you can act through your characters to the point where you are the characters, whether it's a dog or a rabbit or a bird or a robot, it doesn't matter. But if you are the character well enough to act through that character, and then the words and the acting bring your audience right into that fantasy world with you. And when somebody's in your fantasy world, that connection is palpable. I mean, you really do bond with people so closely because of that. So all audiences, as long as they are interested in the topic. I mean, I'm tired of people who look at their, you know, who look at their iPads and who walk out. And it's getting harder and harder for me to be respectful to my audience if they're not respectful to me.
Right. And I think that's what makes creator visits so memorable, is, like you said, that chemical bond between someone who is a real reader or is an aspiring creator themselves, that there's a real sort of reverence and a connection to, you know, people like you. So I think that's amazing. Lynn, I don't know how you're going to like this question. Have you had any experience using, like, doing virtual visits with Skype or anything like that?
I have.
And how is that?
I mean, Skype is a great resource. It's a great tool.
Except if you look like shit.
But you only have to look good from here up, so I'm usually wearing, like, pajama bottoms and bunny slippers when I do Skype visits. Usually Skype visits are short. Usually they're a half an hour, and you don't have to travel to Denver to make them happen. So that's, you know, you only have to be present for that short amount of time. And you can still make the same kinds of wonderful connections with people by sharing yourself and your anecdotes and, you know, getting a question from a child, and then being able to answer them directly and look at them while you're speaking. But there's also just a technology glitch, and sometimes my internet will go down in the middle of a Skype visit, and sometimes I'll try to draw something for them, and they just can't see what I'm drawing because the camera's not picking it up well, or, you know, so there's reasons why it's not perfect, but I think it's so much better than not being able to have an author in your library at all. And if you're looking at it from the librarian's point of view, it's a lot cheaper to bring in an author via Skype than it is to do in person.
Right. Do you charge for Skype visits?
Yes.
I'm just curious.
Yeah,
you know.
Good. I do.
It's your time.
I also worked with an event coordinator for several years. I'm now working just with Scholastic, but for a while I had somebody who was sort of like a booking agent that I would pay a percentage of whatever I made for school visits, library visits, Skype visits, everything. And that was really handy to have somebody else, like, doing the emailing and setting everything up, because that was the thing I thought that was taking away so much of myself.
Yeah.
When I should be creating, I was typing emails about, this is what I would like for lunch that day. So that's part of why I was getting paid for Skype visits, was that Kate was like, please, this is her fee, and then I need to get a percentage of that fee. So.
Of course.
I've only done two. I've done one Skype, and one where it was almost like a Twitter, where myself and Jan Elliott, who does Stone Soup, which is a great strip, the two of us were interviewed, and we could only give so many words.
Right.
And the person typing typed like a million miles an hour, and then would try and contract the sentence to fit into the space. And for me it was, well, these are neat questions, and I think we're giving neat answers, but how fulfilling is it for you and it's not very fulfilling for me. It was like, you know, try and get it done as fast as you can in as few words as possible, which was a challenge to see if my brain is sort of hitting Alzheimer's level. But other than that, it was not a good experience. Mm-hmm. I came out of there kind of dizzy thinking, well, glad it's over. Other than, you know, as I said, every time I'm at a venue, I love it. I'm a ham, and I love to entertain, and I love to draw, and when you're a little electronic image, and they're looking up your nostrils, and you're looking at some guy who is also in their basement,
One thing that's weird about Skype is that I think not every kid in the room, like, realizes what's going on, so you'll see them, like, scratching their noses, and, like, getting up, and, like, being really restless. It's like they don't realize you're actually looking at them on the screen. So sometimes it's just a little awkward.
Maybe because kids are they're so much more concrete, so, you know, when a creator is standing in front of them, they're like, oh, okay, they're there. But maybe with Skype, it's a little bit of a disconnect.
Yeah.
So I wanted to open up the floor to questions now. If anybody has any questions about creator visits or questions about Raina and Lynn's work. Yeah?
I just wanted to say, like, as a queer person of color, it means so much to see these characters represented. And I was wondering, when you're doing visits, do you ever get people who look to you as an ally? And how do you respond to that?
Both answer this. Do you want to go first? Or?
I have not had a whole lot of that. Very quiet, very private connections, mostly by mail. And it's wonderful. It's wonderful.
I wrote Drama, which is a book that has queer characters of color, and it's aimed at middle school students. And in some ways, that kind of rocked the boat. Like, there were people in Tennessee that, like, canceled my visits that were coming up, and I do get, like, nasty letters from parents sometimes, but at just about every visit I've done since publishing Drama, I'll have one kid who, like, takes me aside after the visit and is like, thank you, in their own way, too, and sometimes these kids are, like, 7 or 8 years old, and they're not even sure how to process it yet, but I had one little girl, she was probably, like, 9, and she was with her family and her friends, and she was like, can you guys leave? Can you go over there? Because I need to talk to Raina. And so then she came up to me, and she was just like, like I said, she just didn't know how to process it. But she was like, thanks for writing about characters who are different. And then she ran away. It was super cute.
When I did the story of Lawrence coming out, he was probably in his later teens, and it was long enough ago that really it was terrifying what happened. I mean, I had death threats, and I had thousands, literally thousands of letters. I took them all to the university, and their sociology department, you know, checked them out. They said 73% were positive. The rest were negative, but the negative ones were so horrible that they were actually terrifying. And I got phone calls from editors from all over Canada and the States, mostly the States. Canada's too busy keeping warm and watching hockey. But, I got all this mail, these phone calls from editors from small papers who were accessible by people. So if you are actually publishing the stuff in your community, people who are the hateful bunch will attack you. And so these editors would say, I want to run your strip. My brother is gay, but I can't because my kids have been attacked at school and my dog was spray painted and, you know, we have to quit. So I'm surprised if it's still happening today as much as it was then. But my wonderful comeuppance is that the strip is being run a second time. So Lawrence is now Michael's best friend. They're having sleepovers. They're best buddies. They go camping together. And for the people who've read For Better or For Worse the full way through, we'll know that this is the kid next door. And they'll know that his story. And Lawrence's father is Brazilian and very dark. And his mom is Canadian and French-Canadian. And so Lawrence is colored, and he's always been different, and different in other ways. But I think it's great fun for people who have read it to know that, this is the kid next door. I know what's going to happen to him. And others say, thank you, this is the kid next door. And we know something extra about him. And For me, it was one of the best things I ever did. And I did it for my good friends, one of whom was a writer, comedy writer for the Toronto, for the CBC in Toronto. And he was actually murdered, and his murderer was considered a poor kid who probably was molested, which wasn't true. He was, and so for Michael, I did the story. It was that incentive. It was, this is for you, Michael. And it was a scary situation. I never knew what the opponents were like.
And both representations of queer characters in both of your works are done in such nuanced, delicate, thoughtful, warm ways, which is amazing. They're not, you know, sensational or, you know, I'm doing this for attention or anything. That it's just, they're, you know, both representations extremely important for sort of the body of LGBT literature, especially with comics. So, yeah, definitely applaud you both for that. Any other questions? Yep, go ahead.
I have a couple of questions. I'll ask one other people talk. I wanted to ask, Lynn, you're one of the few strips, and correct me if I'm wrong with this, but to age, have your characters naturally age. What was the decision-making process for that? Like, why did you decide to kind of, like, just move forward with them rather than keep them?
Does everybody hear the question?
I'm sorry.
The question was that why did the characters, and for better or for worse, age? What was the reason for doing that? And there was no reason. It's that I wanted to keep them young forever and ever, like Family Circus. But my own kids kept getting older. And their humor was different, and their perspective was different, and our relationship to them was different, and their friends became part of the family. And to try and write and produce something for that length of time with, you know, having to produce so much, if you keep everything static, you need writers after a while. And I did not want to work with writers. I wanted to create my own stuff. So by having the characters grow older, not only did I challenge myself to draw them differently, but I also gave myself new opportunities for storylines and for humor. It was the thing that sustained the strip was to grow the characters older and older. And people who tried to license for better or for worse, like for example, somebody wanted to put April on a Pampers box, right? Well, by the time you've negotiated and done the contract and designed everything, the kid is now a year older, and that wouldn't work. So I was unable to license a lot of stuff, except for Farley, but Farley the dog died, right? So you don't see a lot of, for better or for worse, merchandise, or you don't see a lot of stuff out there because I did age them. But for me, that was the only way to sustain a self-propelled project that didn't require writers.
Did you have any sort of, like, pushback from your editors? Or?
No, never. No, the only pushback was that one editor wanted it to be American. And I said, are you crazy? You guys can't even agree from one end of the country to the other. I mean, a Los Angeles person can't write about being in New York, for heaven's sake. So, you know, I said, no, I won't sign the contract if that's the case. And I said, you can have your editors change racket to CK and check to CK, but I'm doing what I'm doing. So they left me alone.
And this American had no idea it was a Canadian strip. Until I saw it written as C-H-E-Q-U-E. It was like, huh? I was a kid, so I didn't know what was going on. And then I figured it out. And I was really fascinated by that. Because it didn't feel like it was anything but my American life.
I have to say that I met Rena a long time ago, and you gave me a copy of Smile. And it was one of these events where a lot of people are giving you a lot of things, and a lot of things you leave in the hotel room for them to deal with. And this book I took home with me, and I read again and again and again. I have to tell you, you are amazing.
Thanks.
You are just so good at what you do.
Thanks. Wow, best day ever.
And I have to say that's rare. There are a lot of people who want to get into this industry and who just can't make it. They just can't. And it's for a number of reasons. But they often get angry that they're not admitted. But it's a specific skill set that is something you can't learn. It's almost there. And if you have it, you have it. And you got it.
Well, thanks. You too.
Well, you know, we've managed to plug our way through a crazy industry and get out there and get published. And with everything you publish, there is an equal and opposite reaction. And dealing with that is impressive, too, because you sometimes lose a sense of self when you're out there. And it's important, I think, to fail a few times and to be knocked down a few times and to struggle quite a bit. Because once you start to think you're good at what you do, it falls. And so I think I'm glad I quit when I quit, because I think it was at a good level. And if I was to start the strip now, it wouldn't be as good at all again.
Well, you wouldn't start the strip now, but you might start something else now. And I'd love to see something.
We'll talk.
Collaboration, maybe?
No. I'll just tell
you
what I'm up to.
Any other questions? We've got time for maybe one or two more questions. Yep. Just tell her that there are flamboyantly gay guys and there are more straight
gay guys.
She knows that,
but she's just like, I think she would have preferred if it had been like just guys who like weren't obviously gay. Like, to kind of, I think she, I don't know.
She'd like my friends very much if she
didn't. I'm still very much. She's a very fine person and she's very accepting and I'm making herself comfortable.
No!
So I think we're finished up here, so please give these two cartoons to me.